with the Flaherty budget's tax increases for the lowest tax bracket to 15.25% in 2006 and 15.5% in 2007. Disrespect chooses not to analyze any subtleties, given the only relief for this raise in taxes is the employment tax credit and the GST credit. We can only note that there is no GST on rent and food, which are the two biggest expenditures for people in that tax bracket, and that by crediting only people who are employed, Jim Flaherty, as federal Santa Claus, manages only to penalize the most disadvantaged in our society. If you'd like to see more about the thrust of this budget, pick out William Watson's column in the Thursday, May the 4th Post, "Why Are Tories Shaping Society?" In the column, Watson offers a quote delivered by a letter writer to The Economist and credited to Henry David Thoreau, more appropriate to this week's topic. "If I knew of a certainty that a man was coming to my house with the conscious design of doing me good, I should run for my life." Welcome to Disrespect, exploring the stigma around disability, providing information and interviews to entertain and challenge listeners who care about, or care for, or may themselves have become someone with a disability. Jennifer, I'd like to welcome you to the show.
It's a pleasure.
What's your position again?
I'm coordinator of the Empowerment Council, which is an independent organization representing clients at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health.
Very good. And you have some views on inappropriate research, inappropriate prescription, and inappropriate use of drugs from the patient point of view?
Yes, I've done quite a bit of research, teaching, and advocacy in the area. For a while, we were delivering an Ontario-wide educational program on clients' view of treatment that they experienced, including pharmacological treatment. We based that partly on research evidence. We found that a lot of the more well-conducted research is not the research on which treatment is always based.
Oh. So are you saying that there is well-conducted research, but it is ignored? Or you're saying there is well-conducted research, but there is a lot more that is not well-conducted, and it, because of the volume of it, the treatment's based on it?
Well, there's a bias in how research is conducted.
Mm-hmm.
And the bias results from the most of the money for research coming from the companies that profit from the medications that are being researched.
So it is the most profitable medications that receive corporate-oriented research.
Well, it's more that when medications are being assessed, conflict of interest for researchers in finding that medications are problematic if they want to continue to receive research money.
Yes. I see. So there's a very big disincentive to finding problems with medication.
There is, and to do research well on a medication, for example, you should be comparing a medication to an active placebo.
Right.
So, for example, it's better when looking at, say, antidepressants, to compare them with something that has an effect so that the study isn't unblinded by people realizing that they're not getting anything in the one case and feeling physical effects in the other case.
Right.
So, for example, a better conducted research might be, rather than comparing an antidepressant with a sugar pill, would be to compare an antidepressant with, say, an antihistamine.
Okay.
Or, say, a new antidepressant with an old antidepressant.
So the people have to distinguish the effects rather than just identify that there is an effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're calling on the critical judgment of your, for lack of a better word, subjects, research subjects.
Yeah, it means that the person, what they say, because you always have to take into account the placebo effect.
Right.
So people know they're getting a medication, so they expect it to help.
Right.
So you have to tell the difference between that and the drug actually having an effect. Whereas if you just use a sugar pill, the person can probably tell that they're not on a real medication. But if you give the person antihistamine, they can tell they're on a medication, so it makes a more accurate comparison between the medication that's being studied and the one that's not being studied.
All right. So how does this affect the publication of drugs in the professional literature and any other media that people who prescribe these drugs, mostly doctors, I guess, would use?
Well, there's been a few authors that have written about the problems with the bias in publication of research as a result of the way that research is funded now. And David Healy, one of the major authors in the area, and an example would be what happened with Elizabeth Oliveri.
Oh, yeah, at the hospital for sick kids.
Yeah, where negative results were, the company was saying they had to suppress negative results, basically, that were showing up in the research. Even if the person thinks there's an ethical problem with doing so, they can be sued for revealing dangers of the medication.
How is that? How can they be sued for revealing something that's legitimately found in unbiased research?
Because they sign contracts with the funder. Because a pharmaceutical company funds their own research, they have the researchers are basically under contract to them. So, for example, a researcher might do a study, and the pharmaceutical company, if they don't like the results, they won't necessarily publish the results.
I understand that, but the researcher can actually be sued for publishing the truth.
Well, that's I believe that was the threat that was made to him in the case of Elizabeth Oliveri.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a little frightening, isn't it?
It is.
How have we let ourselves get into this position? Have we withdrawn funding for research that was more impartial?
Universities used to have more funding for research that came from, say, central funding organizations that weren't necessarily industry-based, but now there's very little of that available anymore. It's mostly private funding.
Where did it come from in the past?
I think it came more from, say, central Canadian research foundations, places like that.
Right. And it's been deprived of funding, has it?
And the universities themselves used to have more funding available.
Has this foundation been deprived of funding?
That was just an example of a general type of place that would still that would make funding available to people. There still is central government-based funding organizations, but they don't fund nearly as much as they used to. And the majority of funding for pharmaceutical research comes from private industry.
Has the demand for funding also grown while the supply has been shrinking?
There's more medications being produced all the time. There's constant pressure on the market to approve medications. So I'm not sure what the comparison is, sort of past and present, but it's a constant pressure on the market.
Okay. What effects are you observing as an advocate for patients?
I think partly what's happened in society as a whole is that as we've tended to become more conservative in the last decade or so, people are more satisfied to look to biology to explain social ills instead of looking at the need for social change.
You mean a kind of foreordained outlook, a sense that that some people are fated not to do well or not to survive?
Yeah, and that when things do go wrong in people's lives,
they're meant to.
You don't need to look at the social structure or the social system and how equitable it is. You don't need to re-examine sort of the family and the way that that's working. And poverty is a significant determinant of health, both mental health and physical health. But if that was actually getting all the attention that it should have, there would be more of a cry, I think, to change our social structure. Instead, what's being sold to people now is that any mental or emotional disturbance has its roots in biology. So you read
what does that mean, that it has its roots in biology?
Well, that's where you read that depression is actually a biochemical imbalance.
Oh.
That the primary treatment that's there for should be with antidepressants.
Oh, and it's not environmental or behavioral. Okay.
Yeah, an example would be there's a press release that came out some years ago about studies of the workplace. And they found that workplace stress, and therefore depression in the workplace, had increased greatly in the last decade or so as a result of job insecurity.
Yep.
And therefore the loss of benefits, people working longer hours out of fear of losing their jobs, more workplace competition, and therefore relationship stress in the workplace. All these sort of things have changed. Then they say, what's the solution? The number one, the very first solution they mention is antidepressants. Do they not see the disconnect between what they're talking about as cause and what they're talking about as
solution?
Yeah, and that's true in a lot of different areas of psychiatry.
So I'm looking beyond what you're saying now, and what I'm seeing is a lot of people who are being, for want of a better phrase, taken advantage of, or who can't cope, let's put it that way, with the demands that are being made of them, and they're simply being drugged to accept it.
Yeah, I think that is what's happening.
Is the medical profession a witting or unwitting accomplice in this growing conservatism?
I think both. I think that to some extent doctors benefit from the authority that they gain from having problems rooted in biology. Certainly. The assumption that people's problems are rooted in biology and therefore medical doctors would be the experts. However, I also think that there's a great deal of pressure put on doctors, GPs, and psychiatrists to come up with quick solutions. And there's expectations of mental health professionals that are unrealistic.
Quick turnaround? You mean quick intervention and then total solution and never no future involvement, that kind of therapeutic approach?
I think quick solutions.
Yeah.
And
cheap solutions, maybe, eh?
And the ability to really know what's going on with someone without a lot of in-depth conversation and relationship building.
Do you think this has its roots in funding? Quick solutions got to be a cheap one, eh?
Yeah, I think that it's partly that. Yeah, it seems economical. I think actually it's more costly in the long run.
Right.
Because a lot of the medications have lasting negative effects.
I see. Quick verbal therapy, but then long-term medication. Yeah.
Well, I think what happens is that the thing that's always tried first now, instead of verbal therapy, the thing that's always tried first is medication.
Oh.
And I think it should be the opposite.
Yeah.
I think unless someone is in such extreme distress that they need to, say, have their anxiety lulled for a while so they can benefit from verbal therapy, I think that which does the least harm is that which should be tried first.
Oh, it seems consistent with the doctor's oath.
Yeah, they don't actually have that oath in Canada, the Hippocratic Oath.
No.
No.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
We didn't know that. You heard it here first. What oath do they take?
I don't know, actually. I learned that not long ago myself.
So that's an American oath.
Well, I'm not sure what other countries use it, but it's not used here. I heard someone challenging the doctor, actually, about the use of psychiatric medication, saying, what about the Hippocratic Oath? And he said, we don't have that in Canada. So that's all I know.
Oh, dear. Okay. It sounds as if a doctor then who proposed a less interventionary therapy and a longer term, more verbal therapy would be less likely to succeed in this environment. He would be less likely to get funding. He'd be less likely to get patients. He'd come under pressure from, if not his peers, certainly his funders, to deliver results that were longer in coming.
Depends on the work environment. I don't think actually he'd have less patients. I think he'd have a big lineup of patients.
Right.
In fact, I always have people calling me asking me for psychiatrists who are not so medication-oriented. A lot of people want psychiatrists who will help them get off their medication, for example, and who will deal with them purely verbally. And
right.
It's not that easy to find someone who's willing to help someone withdraw from medication.
Oh, I see. That's unfortunate.
Yeah. I think particularly in the institutional setting where I tend to work, it's almost unheard of for someone to not be given medication. It doesn't appear as if the question is asked, should this person have medication, but rather, what kind?
Well, it's been relayed to me that if you wish to qualify for support as disabled with a mental matter, that although it's probably not written anywhere, it, practically speaking, if you're not on medication, you're not regarded as disabled.
That's true. There's a bias in the disability funding, where people have to say, you know, that they're disabled and they're going to be disabled for a long time, and it has to be a disease, and the doctor has to assess it.
So almost by definition, medical to get the funding.
Yeah. Certainly there's people who don't believe that their source of their problems is at all an illness. They may be quite well aware, for example, that it came from a long history of abuse and deprivation.
Right.
They have to say that it's an illness in order to get disability support.
Well, and even then, today, they may not get the disability support.
Yeah.
It's very tight.
Yeah.
Is that another pressure? It is, isn't it?
Poverty?
Well, yeah. I mean, poverty and some degree of relief for it, for medicalizing your problem.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Creates a bias.
That's all the time we have this week. Come back next week for the conclusion of this interview on Disrespect. Born July 2, 1952, pianist Gene Taylor recorded and toured with incredible rock and blues greats, from Canned Heat to the Fabulous Thunderbirds, lending his keyboard skills internationally. He's currently the keyboard man with the Fabulous Thunderbirds, the quintessential American band formed in 1974 by Jimmy Vaughn, Stevie Ray Vaughan's brother, and Kim Wilson, current frontman and harpist. Indeed, Taylor interrupted the Thunderbirds' national tour to take part in this year's Boogie Woogie Show, an event near and dear to his heart. His repertoire includes recording and touring with the Blasters, classic rockers, also Ricky Nelson, James Harmon, James Hammond, and the Downchild Blues Band. From 81 to 85, the Blasters made four critically acclaimed albums for Warner Brothers, but Los Angeles native Taylor, now living in Toronto, gained his reputation by playing with artists such as T-Bone Walker, Joe Turner, Pee Wee Creighton, and Lowell Fulsom. In the early 1970s, he joined Canned Heat, the rock blues act which gave him international exposure in the heyday of the anti-war movement. Then he moved to Canada to play piano with Ronnie Hawkins, living between Canada and the U.S. for years. In 88, with friends Doug Syme and Amos Garrett, he won a Juno Award, Canada's equivalent of a U.S. Grammy. In the last 10 years, Taylor's toured the world with the Thunderbirds, Tough Enough, Wrap It Up, etc., but his boogie piano is his trademark. He's turned many concertgoers into fans with his unique licks and by also performing as a soloist occasionally. Compare his piano-thumping style with the keyboard domination of Malcolm Rabinac, born November 21, 1940 in New Orleans, Louisiana. a colorful pianist, singer, and songwriter whose music spans and often combines blues, boogie-woogie, and rock and roll. Professor Longhair was an important influence on Rebinac, known as Dr. John. His musical career began as a session musician in New Orleans in the 1950s. Early on, he also played guitar and was often known as Mac Rebinac. He switched to the piano after his index finger was nearly shot off, protecting his bandmate, Jesuit high school classmate and longtime friend Ronnie Barron. He gained fame beginning in the late 60s and early 70s with music that combined New Orleans-style rhythm and blues with psychedelic rock and stage shows that bordered on voodoo religious ceremonies, including elaborate costumes and headdress. For a time, he was billed as Dr. John the Night Tripper. The name Dr. John came from a legendary Louisiana voodoo practitioner from the start of the 19th century. Ask if he considers himself a legendary blues pianist. As his press release so proudly champions, he declares without a trace of cynicism, "I just consider myself a guy who plays the piano. I love to play the blues. I started off as a studio guitar player back in the 50s, and basically I was wanting to be a T-Bone Walker, so that's the blues. If people ain't aware of the blues, they're missing the one thing American culture ever produced. I think if it wasn't for jazz, blues, and gospel music, there wouldn't be too much culture in this country," he says. You heard at the middle of the show, Gene Taylor and Gene's Boogie. Coming up, Dr. John and Boxcar Boogie.